All right, we're back with side two, same discussion from the other side. And look, you'd like to continue?
In the spring of 1942, after Singapore and Burma had fallen, it was known that nothing except a very attenuated Hawkins army stood between the Japanese and Calcutta. As the Bengalis are notorious for their complete lack of military prowess, much thought was given to the formation of leave-behind parties and the personnel who would man them. Finally, it was decided that locally, only the communists would prove to be an effective force. One complication was that at that time, the Communist Party was an illegal body, most of its members having been put in jail and the rest having gone underground. The secretary of the Communist Party in India, P.C. Joshi, was contacted, and it was agreed at very high level, Inspector Generals of Police and the Commander 4136, that on the advice of Mr. Joshi, various communists would be allowed to escape from prison. This is where I came in to arrange transport for them and for their reception at our commando training school at Lake Karagrasla, which was 19 miles from Pune and about 90 miles from Bombay, where I was stationed. There, Percy's boyfriend, the code name I coined for them, would be instructed in demolition procedures and on such specific targets in Calcutta as the Howrah Bridge, power station, marshalling yards, etc. Whenever I read that a train had been derailed, I would wonder whether it was done by someone we had trained. Here, perhaps, I'm only talking about Force 136. The first time I had to visit the underground headquarters of the Communist Party, I went with considerable trepidation, as it was located in a part of Bombay not usually visited by Europeans, and particularly not by a woman. With the need for strict security in mind, I took a taxi to the Taj Mahal Hotel, paid it off, and walked through the hotel to another entrance, took a new taxi, and told the driver to go to Kethwadi, 140 Kethwadi Main Road. At first, I was so het up, I barely noticed when we left the redolent, crowded bustle of the bazaars and turned into almost deserted, grey, colourless streets. On arrival, I asked the driver to wait, as it would have been nearly impossible to get another taxi in that area. That part of Kethwadi Main Road consisted of a series of modern, though dingy, apartment blocks. And fortuitously, from my point of view, there was a central entrance for numbers 140, 142, and 144. Inside the hall, I started up the stairs of 142, the word underground being somewhat of a misnomer, as the office was on the top floor. The stairway was ill-lit and was covered with red stains looking suspiciously like blood, and although I expect they were made by betel nut spit, they did nothing to allay my qualms. Also, there was a constant stream of people who brushed past me, and loud gusts of laughter and high-pitched giggles emanated from behind the closed doors on the landings, obviously bottles. Mm-hmm. On arrival at the fifth floor, I was surprised to find the normal-looking office presided over by Mr. Joshi, who greeted me with a closed-fist salute. I thought it best to avoid possible misunderstandings in the future, to say that, although I would do my utmost to help him in this facet of the war, my political opinions were diametrically opposed to his. I think he was surprised at my candour, but all our future dealings were carried out in a very cordial and amicable manner. I found him to be extremely efficient, ruthless, and almost frighteningly intelligent. He'd been trained in Russia. Having completed my business, I returned to find the taxi driver in earnest conversation with a man who was obviously a plainclothes police detective. And I was glad that by asking for 140 instead of 142, I might have thrown him off from finding out the real purpose of my visit. Paid off the taxi at a large department store, walked through to another entrance and took a third taxi back to our office on Marine Drive, hoping that my tracks had been covered. I went back using variations of the same tactics on numerous occasions, as Albert, my co-walker, who should have gone, was not usually available. I was amused that when taking large sums of money, presumably to bribe warders, I was ordered to carry the Browning 3-2 automatic, which had been issued to me, and with which I become fairly adept. Panda by myself, it didn't matter if I was armed or not. In any event, its use against the crowd would most probably have been completely ineffectual. I often wondered what portion of the money went in bribes and how much to swell the coffers of the Communist Party. When I began to look upon the visits as routine, I noticed that the taxi drivers would give me a peculiar look when I asked to go to 140 Ketwadi Main Road. It was not until some time later that I discovered that there was an abortionist at 140.
Good God.
Of course, from a security point of view, this is all to the good. But I must have been thought to have a magnificent constitution, as within 15 or 20 minutes I would return to the taxi, apparently unperturbed, though possibly a little breathless from the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, I must have been considered incredibly careless, as I would return sometimes twice, or even three times in a month.
Well, the English are still as I think.
I think so. It was late one afternoon when I decoded a telegram for our office in Colombo to the effect that owing to the monsoon, the plane of one of our VIPs had been delayed, and he would therefore miss the twice-weekly commercial flight from Bombay to Delhi, and would I lay on an RAF plane to take him there the next afternoon, as it was imperative for him to keep an appointment the following day in Delhi. As I'd only recently arrived, I didn't know any RAF personnel in Bombay, so I contacted the army security officer whom I'd met officially and asked him to get in touch with his opposite number in the RAF and to vouch for me. At that time, the office cover was Assistant Inspector of Military Explosives, which was about as much good as a thick headache, and I'd found it more effective to requisition things in my own name. Sorry. After a few minutes to give him time to be briefed, I telephoned the RAF security officer and told him my predicament. He suggested I ring up several RAF bases in the area, and if there was any difficulty, refer the commanding officers to him. You can imagine that during the war, when security was very much the concern of everyone in the services, it took quite a bit of persuasion to get through to the commanding officer, and even more to bluntly ask if I could borrow a plane. To my surprise, the first three stations had no available planes, all service of ones having been sent to the Western Desert. But it was suggested that I contact the wing commander in charge of the RAF station at Juhu, who might have an operational plane. I rang the base immediately and was informed by the second in command that there was a plane available that the wing commander had left for a night in the town with his girlfriend and would be staying at the Majestic Hotel. I was almost in despair, as time was getting short, but rang up the hotel, and as he'd not arrived, left a message for him to ring me at home on a matter of some urgency. It was then after 7 o'clock, and I had a very special date for dinner, so I left the office and rushed home to change. As I was not in the habit of leaving messages for strange males to call me up, the whole procedure was a bit nerve-wracking, but after several more attempts, I eventually got through to him. He confirmed he had a plane, but said before he could lend it to me, he must have approval from his headquarters in Delhi, and suggested that I should meet him at the local RAF headquarters at 8:30 a.m., as there was a reserved time phone call to Delhi, and I could then tell him my reasons for acquiring the plane, as I thought it unwise to go into details on the telephone. The next morning, although I had danced until after midnight, and wearing a hyacinth blue linen dress to give me encouragement, I arrived at the headquarters and met by a very dusty, whack... that is Women's Auxiliary Army Corps India sergeant, who looked me up and down disdainfully, but on hearing I wanted to see the wing commander, she disappeared. Shortly afterwards, a very young pilot officer came and said I couldn't possibly see him, as four wing commanders were in conference. His tone of awe sounded as if I wished an interview with the Almighty himself. When I said they were probably waiting for me, he looked incredulous and disappeared, but came back wide-eyed and rather flustered, saying they were expecting me. To my amusement, he led me to the conference room, all the way trying unsuccessfully to pump me as to why I was there. The wing commander was pleasant, but non-committal. When the call came through, I felt it was my lucky day, as Air Vice Marshal Darfield was on the line, and he'd known me in Singapore. So it was not too long before I was authorized to have the plane that afternoon. A few weeks later, I was dining at the Taj Mahal, which was, and probably still is, Hotel in Bombay. Whilst waiting for our table to be ready, we went into the bar. Suddenly, above the hubbub, a loud voice called out to me across the room. You know that plane I lent you the other day has never been the same since. It's bent. It was the wing commander with a party of brother officers. I was somewhat embarrassed at being singled out in public as a person who could borrow our airplanes, but not too surprised at its condition as our VIP, a multimillionaire member of parliament, weighed over 336 pounds. I only hoped people would not think it was my weight that had bent it. When I was asked to go to our commander's school at Karakvasla to teach the instructors how to do codes and ciphers, I was excited. As I'd heard so much about the camp and had either met or spoken on the telephone to most of the staff. It was decided that it would disrupt the office least if I left on the 8 a.m. train on Saturday, spent the night and return on Sunday morning. I was met at Poona by a couple of the instructors, and one said, I'm so glad to see you, but we're also supposed to meet some old battle axe who's going to teach us how to code. I smiled but said nothing, as I didn't feel at that time their description was too accurate. The camp was still under construction, but the main block, consisting of the officers' mess, administration offices, and some quarters, was completed. But dotted around were hutments in various stages of construction. On arrival, the commandant asked me to start instructing the staff. Among them was one rather embarrassed red-faced officer. All officers are expected to learn how to code, instructors and students alike. We used various pocketbooks, and Pygmalion was particularly favoured, and the amount of messages based on no bloody fear, I'm going to take a taxi, was incredible. The codes took the form of acrostics, the message being written horizontally, then vertically, and finally in groups of five letters. Ciphers were a different matter, and for security reasons, only those who would never be involved in operational activities in the field were allowed to learn their intricacies. To begin with, the War Office cipher book, which had been compromised in the First War, was used with frequently changed reciphering tables so that a word would never appear the same twice running. The main problem was accuracy with either codes or ciphers, because if there was a mistake of even one letter or figure, the whole message was thrown out. We stopped for lunch, and afterwards, as a treat, I was taken to the small arms range. To digress, a short time after I had been issued with the Browning 3-2 automatic, which I called Annabella, I was offered as a replacement a gorgeous silver-plated Colt 2.5 revolver with mother-of-pearl handles. But I felt it to be a bit pansy, and with regret, I refused it. Subsequently, I was amused as he'd been used by a particularly tough commander. Various officers passing through Bombay had taught me how to use Annabella, take her down, clean and oil her, and put her together again. In true commander style, one should aim with the elbow firmly pressed on one's navel. But the female anatomy has certain protuberances which make this impossible. However, I did my best, and the only other unorthodox variation I made was that before using Annabella, I put some lavender water on a piece of cotton wool and rubbed it over her to take away the oily smell. The small arms range was a large, dimly lit hall, where a figure would appear suddenly for a second or two, then another followed, possibly by several at once. As I left Annabella in Bombay, the deputy commandant left me his coat 4-5, which he said, pulled slightly to the right. I tried to adjust, and although it had a terrific kick, I was thrilled to find I had made more vital hits than he, an experienced commando, had. After this short interlude, I went back to check on the progress being made in codes and ciphers. Sometime later, I was interrupted and asked if I could possibly help pay the construction workers, as the adjutant, whose job it was, had gone down with malaria and no one else spoke the language. There were roughly 90 coolies, and the complication was that of the 450 rupees to be distributed, there were only 3 5-rupee notes, 11 ones, and a couple of rupees in change, and the rest were in 10-rupee notes, and of course the banks were shut. As the majority of the coolies were women whose pay averaged 3.5 to 3.75 rupees, it seemed an impossible task. However, with the help of the overseer, I managed to get together three women from the same village and gave them a 10 and 1 rupee note on the understanding they would give the extra change to the next group and so on. To begin with, there was bedlam, with much protesting and shrieking that their husbands would beat them if they didn't arrive at their correct pay. But after repeated explanations, given at the top of my voice, the only way I could be heard, they calmed down. At the end of 3 hours, when the last one was paid, I was left with no voice and utterly exhausted. After a hot bath in a galvanized iron tub in the commandant's quarters and a change into a long evening dress, we not left my luggage at the hotel in Pune where I was to spend the night, and a long, cool drink, I felt somewhat better. We dined in the mess, and, as I was the first woman to do so, the cook had made a special effort, and although my voice was still non-existent, it was a hilarious meal. There was a night exercise. As there was a night exercise, only 8 of us went on to dance at the Pune Club. Luckily for me, they were all good dancers, so I had a marvellous time, and although feeling rather weary, danced until 2 a.m. I was up much too early for Sunday morning, as I was having breakfast at the mess, and I wanted one more session of codes and ciphers and to see over the camp before leaving on the 11 o'clock train. I was amused to see the difference in attitude of the coolies. The day before, they looked inquisitively at me out of the corners of their eyes, wondering what I was doing in this male preserve. But now, having paid them, made feeble jokes and outshouted them, I was greeted with broad smiles, low salaams, and great respect. On arrival at the station, I was told that owing to a derailment, the train was making a detour. I couldn't help wondering whether Percy's boys had been experimenting. Anyway, instead of taking a couple of hours, the train didn't arrive in Bombay until 7 o'clock, and there was no refreshment car. After having a bath and dinner, I was told that some most immediate top secret cipher cables had arrived. At this time, we had our own radio station, and so I went to the office and started deciphering them. We had a dear old bearer, the head... man of the servants, who on these occasions would appear every hour or so with a cup of black coffee, which he put beside me, and having stirred in the sugar, left without a word. He did this entirely off his own bat, and I must say I was most grateful for his thoughtfulness. I finished deciphering at 2:15, went home, and was back at the office at 8:30. This period of the war, I didn't get much sleep. It may be remembered that Portugal was neutral during the war, and that Goa was their last enclave on the west coast of India. Sometime prior to 1942, one Italian and three German ships were interned in Goa. Contrary to regulations, the Ehrenfeld managed to secrete a radio transmitter which gave information to all sailings to and from Bombay to enemy submarines in the vicinity with disastrous results to our shipping. Although many plans were made to plug the leak, they were all vetoed by the Foreign Office, who insisted that no overt act be undertaken to jeopardize our use of essential facilities in the Azores. However, it was decided that the Gestapo officer, who was in overall command, and his wife should be kidnapped, and so one Saturday afternoon, two officers left Bombay to pick them up. Our office had recently been moved from our flat on Marine Drive to a large secluded house on Malabar Hill, belonging to a Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who I met quite a lot at that time, a most charming person. Shortly before 8:30 on that Sunday morning, I found the prisoners already installed in the large ground floor room prepared with microphones for them. Unfortunately, the only times they may have said anything interesting was in bed, when their voices were muffled. Their rooms had wide sliding doors onto the hall and facing a staircase which made a convenient seat for the commando, who with a Tommy gun on his knee kept them under constant surveillance. I was asked to make up a cover story for the servants, who were looking a bit puzzled at the strange goings on. After a few minutes' thought, I put a band-aid near the top of my left arm and called all the servants together. I told them that the Saab and Mem Saab had been taken off a ship where they'd been in contact with a frightening disease so new that at this time there were only 3 inoculations against it available, and they'd been given to 2 sobs and me, hence the Band-Aid. And we did have an officer visiting en route to Carrickmacross. I said this was the reason they were to be isolated, and none of the servants were to go near them, and as they might go berserk, the soldier was there to prevent them attacking anyone or hurting themselves. The disease was so infectious that any food left on their plates was to be burnt, and all the silver and china used by them was to be placed in a tub with strong disinfectant and left to soak for at least an hour and kept separate from ours. I also impressed on them the importance of keeping all this a secret, as it might cause panic in the bazaar, particularly if it was thought an epidemic was imminent. We were hoping that the prisoners would give us important information, and so did everything possible to keep them happy, and to this end, I personally served their meals to them. To begin with, I found this rather tricky, as I was told I must make sure the commando had at all times a clear view of them, and although I might be saying, "Would you have some more fruit salad?" or what have you, I must not give them a chance of using me as a shield. At the end of the 2 or 3 weeks they were with us, it became quite routine, and we went back to normal. I was averaging over 70 hours a week, and in the 10.5 months I was in Bombay, had 3 afternoons off. The servants must have taken my words on secrecy to heart, as no rumour of the strange visitors had percolated into the bazaars. But later on, discreet items appeared in the newspaper, giving the impression that they had defected, which it was hoped would have a demoralising effect on their compatriots. The second phase of this Operation Goldfish did not take place until the March 1943 Dark of the Moon period. My very minor part in it consisted in collecting 1 lakh of rupees in gold to bribe the Gurney's chief of police, who agreed to turn a blind eye to possible events if no loss of Gurney's life was entailed, and most important, face was maintained. Borrowing a motor torpedo boat, together with some limpets, explosive devices to scuttle ships from the Navy, and on its completion by members of the Calcutta Light Horse, to arrange for a guard for 8 prisoners. Now, in between this, I want to say there is a book written that has got the whole description of this, and it is various from what mine is. I only knew my operation from what I was involved in. Theirs was quite different. And my operation was that we bribed the chief of police. There was going to be a mela, a fair, for everybody in the town there to go out to, with dancing bears and all sorts of excitement like that. And it was during this time we would try and take the boats. There would be very few people left on them, right? In actual fact, so I'm told, it was arranged that all sailors could go to Brothels for free that night. So, that is their version of it, but this is my version of it.
Who and what is the other book? Who was it written by? Do you remember offhand?
I've got it written down somewhere now, and I can't remember. I'll tell you. May I tell you?
Sure,
you
can. Yeah.
I can't just for the moment like that. By members of this is, and it's on completion by members of the Calcutta Light Horse, who incidentally went down by a boat from Calcutta all the way around the bottom of India to get there. It was a frightful business. It was a paddle thing. Must have been about 8 p.m. when I rang up the area commander, and knowing that there was a Highland regiment in the area, asked if I could borrow for an indefinite but not too long period a discreet Scottish NCO and 6-man guard bearing small arms, and that we would be responsible for their rations, lodgings, etc. I said I couldn't explain why I wanted them on the phone, but was sure that General Festing, VC, commandant of the regular commando training school at Carrickmacross, and later governor of Hong Kong, would vouch for me. Anyway, did the trick, and early next morning the guard arrived, and the exuberant Calcutta Light Horse were able to return by train to celebrate a most successful undertaking. Newspapers headlines appeared, Axis ships gutted in Goa, and German scuttle ships. In August 1943, we went to Simla on a fortnight's leave. When opened, clouds of steam rose for our suitcases, attesting to the almost unbearable heat of the plains. We were looking forward to enjoying the cool kindness of sheets that smooth away trouble, instead of lying even when under a fan in pools of sweaty, prickly heat. Soon after our arrival, we ran into Sir Colin Garbutt, KCIE, CSI, CMG, an old friend, who met us with open arms, and when he heard I was with the Minister of Economic Warfare, said, "You must have been sent by the Lord," not the way I'm usually greeted. He had recently headed a royal commission on the resettlement of troops after the war, and to my surprise wanted my comments. There were only three copies of the report, one of which was borrowed from the Secretary of Defense and brought by hand of a Major General to me. Although in great detail, the main theme was that A. Saltpeter turned vast areas into virtual deserts, and that with the use of service equipment, bulldozers, etc., they could be cleared and with small grants of land and money given to veterans made fertile. B. Separate colonies of Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs would be formed, and a part of each joined to create a collective village with dispensary, post office, market, and other facilities which would not be available to them as separate entities. C. There would be a mill, not the usual one run by bunyas, charging exorbitant rates, but a cooperative serving several villages, of which each landowner would have a share. I felt the scheme was simple but comprehensive, innovative and workable, with little expense should turn useless land into food-producing areas and give permanent employment to many veterans and the satisfaction of ownership. I gather its recommendations formed part of India's first five-year plan. I was honored and thrilled to have been given a preview of it. Incidentally, Colin was a cousin of the rotund Archbishop of York, who, when on tour, forgot to make a laundry list and had his surplus returned to him as one bell tent. When we returned to Meerut from Bombay, we lived in a dilapidated old house that must have once had a nice garden. We found a citrus-type tree with large green and brown mottled fruit. Inside its very tough rind was a delectable apricot-tasting golden thick liquid, rather like the texture of an avocado, but much wetter. The servant said a small glass of it at breakfast would keep one cool through the hottest day. We reveled in it, but unfortunately, its season was much too short. We discovered it was a bale fruit, sometimes called a Bengal quince. We never come across it before or since, which is a great pity, as it was an ambrosial nectar fit for the gods. One day the cook showed us where wild bees had swarmed and made an enormous cluster on a high branch hanging over the roof. He suggested it would be nice to have some honey, and when we agreed, said he would lay on a bee man. The next day, a strange little man appeared, quite unlike the local inhabitants, looking like an Arthur Rackham dwarf, with high pointed ears and a wispy beard. Out of his skimpy loincloth, he produced a dahlia-like root, on which he played to us a silent tune, but all the bees left the hive and flew away. He climbed up, we made him wash beforehand, and filled several jars the cook had sterilized with honey, replacing it with good raw sugar. Then he climbed down, took out his root, and piped, presumably, another tune, and immediately all the bees returned. The whole episode was so bizarre that had I not seen it myself, I might have thought it happened in a dream. But in India, fantastic events become commonplace. Our garden was drenched once or twice a week by a contraption consisting of many earthenware jars. The inferior ones have tin cans attached to a long, sturdy leather strap reaching into the depths of the well. In worked by a wooden wheel turned by a team of bullocks, or even a single one, circling round and round until the water channels throughout the garden had been filled, quenching the thirst of flowers drooping in the heat. I feel filled with nostalgia for the restful rumbling creaks of the Persian wheel and the primitive earth-scented aroma of steam rising from the overflowing water on the sun-baked earth. Okay? after the war ended, I was seconded by the Supreme Allied Commander, South East Asia Headquarters, Lord Mountbatten, to the Far Eastern Bureau of the Political Intelligence Division of His Majesty's Foreign Office, a cumbersome title shortened to FEB, to expedite the repatriation of mostly civilian personnel through service channels to Britain, USA, and Australia, and to send the vast quantity of equipment needed for setting up a broadcasting station in Singapore. I started work on Saturday morning, was briefed by my G2, Major John Eyre, for half an hour, after which he left the salon and didn't return for 3 months. As I began to sort through the mass of papers left for me to cope with, I was told the office closed down on Saturday afternoons to open on Monday. This was bliss indeed, as I think that Sunday would be the first I'd had all since the Jap War began. On Monday, I was faced with a crisis. Our Calcutta office urgently needed one of our station wagons. I was told by a rather offhand Indian clerk that it was already at the railway station awaiting shipment. I took him to check details to the station, and with the help of a nice sergeant from the railway transport office, discovered to my horror that it was intended to forward the car poised on an open trestle when it would surely have arrived without wheels, tires, engine, or any part that could be pried off. I insisted it be moved to a sealed wagon. Various minions from the station master's office came and said it was impossible, and then an engine appeared to shunt it. I was desperate, and to play for time, asked for a chair to be put on the lines between the engine and the trestle, which was directly in front of a bumper, so it could not be attacked from the rear. In retrospect, I can see it must have been an amusing spectacle, but at the time it was rather traumatic, for there I was, sitting in the sun, in the middle of railway lines, with an open parasol recently covered by a gorgeous chintz with enormous white magnolias and green leaves, my back to the station wagon, facing and daring the engine to do its worst. The inevitable crowd appeared. Soon, but it seemed an age, the station master arrived, and on my insistence, and possibly to avoid further delay, agreed the car should be transferred to a sealed wagon. And in due course, this was done. I left my chair with no regrets, climbed up from the rails, and the engine attached the sealed wagon to the next passenger train destined for Calcutta. The changing attitude of all the Indian clerks was very noticeable, and I had no trouble with any of them in the future. The next problem was getting priorities